building on that now, I've been fiddling around with this notion of political generations and looking at millennials as a new political generation. How many people in this room were born between 1980 and 2000? I'm just curious. Looked like a lot of you from just looking around there, so that's cool. So this is about you, maybe, or some of you. Okay, so I've become convinced that this generation is something special, a new political generation, not just a new generation, but a new political generation, as I'll try to explain. And I guess I came to that view mostly out of the Occupy study. You know, young people are always overrepresented in social movements. That's just kind of how it is for a lot of different reasons. One of them is what some sociologists call biographical availability. If you're young, especially if you're a student or underemployed in some way, you don't have a family yet, you don't have a lot of responsibilities, you're more able to make time for this kind of activity. But back in, maybe people would like to sit on the floor here or something?
Yeah, sorry. Well, then let's take standing on the wall.
I see one chair over there. There's a couple chairs here and there, too. Sorry.
Sorry? I don't think he's coming, so.
Digital natives, meaning people who, this isn't coming of age in your, you know, adolescence and 20s, but much earlier, basically being born into a world where social media and digital media more generally were just part of the landscape, which I'm sure you've all noticed. People of my age are not equally proficient at these things. The older people here are giggling. But anyway, so this is another feature of this generation that's new. And it turns out to be quite important in social movements because social media have been quite central in recent times to the emergence and growth of social movements. So as you can see, what I'm suggesting is that this generation, especially, it turns out, college-educated millennials, for reasons we'll get to, so many of you in this room, in other words, are the driving demographic of this new cycle of protest that seems to be emerging in the U.S. and perhaps in Canada, too. You tell me. I don't know enough about what's happening here. But well, that's basically where that's the kind of background to the case studies I'm going to share with you. Now, this goes completely against the conventional wisdom, at least as of a couple of years ago, about the millennial generation. The conventional wisdom is that millennials are selfish, lazy, narcissistic, have a big sense of entitlement. Everybody agrees about the digital piece. They're often presumed to be politically disengaged, to be, dismissive of politics. A lot of the data on millennials comes from research by the Pew Research Center, which has done endless surveys on comparing millennials to other generations. And one of their findings in a recent study was that millennials are, quote, relatively unattached to organized politics. This is an example of the conventional view. Although, look at the last line, wow, they'll save us all. We'll see. Anyway, the me generation. Lazy, entitled, narcissists still live with their parents. Like, that's something that you're doing by choice. Well, okay. This is a unique generation in just sort of conventional demographic terms as well. In the United States, and I suspect it's true in Canada as well, though I'm not sure. This is a generation that's more diverse in terms of race and ethnicity than any of its predecessors. So in the U.S., 43% of millennials are non-white. That would include African-Americans, Latinos, Asians, et cetera. So Latinos are the biggest single group within that given immigration. Millennials are also the most highly educated generation in United States history. So, and that's important because it turns out college-educated millennials are the most likely to be activists in these things I'm going to talk about. So as you can see, a third of, not all millennials are over age 26 yet. The data on who's college educated are based on that group because, well, that age, you can't do it for 18-year-olds for obvious reasons, right? So this is a partial statistic, but anyway, this will continue to be true. However, about two-thirds of millennials have student debt as well, which turns out to be relevant to my story as well. Millennials are also less likely to marry than their predecessors. And that doesn't necessarily stop them from reproducing issues. They're also less religious than earlier generations, which is say earlier, sorry, generations. So 29% of millennials, when asked about their religious affiliation, answer no. So that's higher than any previous generation. The digital natives thing is here again. 91%, this is an old number, it's probably higher by now, are on Facebook, or maybe not, maybe Facebook is passe, I don't know. I'm probably too far. I don't have it in the slideshow, but another statistic I read was that, let's see, what was it? Anyway, there was some other social media example where basically all millennials participated in it, and when boomers, that's my generation, baby boomers, were asked about it, they most of them didn't even know what it was. There's a huge divide that way, as you all know, from your parents and so on. Okay, so the stereotype is of this generation of people who are, always on their phones and so on and so forth, and not particularly interested in politics. But it turns out that at least a subgroup of millennials have been extremely politicized and extremely engaged in politics in the last few years. And I'm going to just talk about two examples of that in some detail, but I think there are others as well. So this first kind of came to the attention of
commentators, academics, and journalists, and others. In 2008, when Barack Obama was running for president and captured the imagination of young people, of millennials, at that time. And as you can see, this was not the only factor, obviously, in his victory, but 66% of voters under 30 voted for him, which is a much higher proportion than of older people. And it's the largest age disparity ever reported in the U.S. electoral history. Perhaps more important for my story, many young people also worked on the Obama political campaign at that time. There was something called Camp Obama, run by a guy called Marshall Gamble. I don't know if that maybe didn't you all. He's a former labor organizer who now teaches organizing at the JFK Kennedy School at Harvard. And he ran something called Camp Obama, where he trained people in political organizing. And anyway, that was all overwhelmingly made up of young people. And of course, the campaign was the first political campaign to make heavy use of social media, which was not an accident. So that was the first time this sort of was hit the political radar of people who pay attention to things like this. And like I mentioned earlier, for me, it became compelling when Occupy Wall Street emerged, as it turns out, as I'll show you in some detail in a minute. This generation was the demographic core of Occupy Wall Street as well. And, now this was earlier actually, millennials also, sort of by definition, are the demographic base of the Dreamers movement. That term, the Dreamers, I don't know how many people here are familiar with this. I'll just explain it in case you're not. The term comes from, it's the acronym for a piece of legislation that's been knocking around in the U.S. Congress without being passed for many years, and it would give, I'm not going to remember the acronym, but it would give legal status to immigrants who came to the United States without documents as children, usually brought by their parents or some relative. And, you know, the logic is, this is as well, for obvious reasons, this is a group that didn't necessarily choose actively to make that journey, and therefore should have some kind of preferential status, and there's a whole complicated history to that. But it starts as part of the broader immigrant rights movement, and then, in a way, becomes independent, and they have adopted the term that they call themselves the Dreamers. And they are, by definition, young because the legislation only applies to that, that demographic group who came as children. I'm not going to really say much about this, though it may be in the discussion we could talk about it, but more recently, Black Lives Matter, it turns out, is also, well, the leadership is overwhelmingly millennial generation. And this is because it's student-based, but there's a recent movement, maybe here in Canada as well, in the U.S., on young, mostly women protesting about sexual assault issues on college campuses, and of course they're also this generation. So arguably, we have a new cycle of protest emerging in the U.S. that, you know, made up of all the different issues, but brought together by the generational dynamic here. And then most recently, if you watched the news last night, you may know that Bernie Sanders today enjoys disproportionate support from this generation. Torn from today's headlines. There have been a number of surveys showing that, you know, it's sort of like what happened with Obama, that the youth vote is really over the edge for him. Okay, so I think that it's kind of obvious that this wave of new activism, and I don't want to exaggerate it, but, you know, there are a lot of different pieces here, but I think collectively they add up to something that we haven't seen for a while, which I would argue is a new cycle of protest. It's still relatively small, but, you know, definitely on the radar. I think it was very much sparked by the Great Recession, not the Dreamers, obviously, which preceded that, but all the others. And this mostly comes out of our study of Occupy. Let me just back up a minute and tell you what we did, because this might be interesting to some of the students who were doing research themselves here in the room. So when Occupy came along in 2011, it was kind of a surprise to all concerned, I think. You know, this was the year of the Arab Spring, other events around the world, but in the U.S. was the last place anyone really expected anything like this to occur, and then there it was on our doorstep for those of us who live in New York City, and of course, as you know, it spread everywhere after that. So when that was happening, I was at a meeting, and I just sort of flashed into my mind because there was one other person at the meeting who had also been present. When I had heard at a conference a few years before a paper about the immigrant rights marches of 2006, some of you are too young to remember those, but I know the immigration people here will know what I'm talking about. It was a really big deal in the United States. It's a long story, which I won't go into here. But anyway, somebody had done a study in Chicago of one of those marches, and they used this methodology from Europe, which involves the following approach. You take a demonstration while it's progressing, or even a moving march, protest march, divide it into geographical segments, assign an interviewer to each segment, and, you know, ask them to interview every 10 person or something like that. So I had never heard of that methodology until I heard the paper about the Chicago march in 2006. And when Occupy marched, we're sitting around talking about interviews and how we should do that. And so basically that is what we did. So I recruited Stephanie and Penny to help me with this, and we hired 50 graduate students to help us, and we surveyed the moving march. So a lot of the data I'm going to share with you from Occupy are from that survey. And then in addition to that, we did a lot of interviewing, just, you know, qualitative interviews with folks. By contrast, I just might as well say this now while I'm talking about this aspect of it. On the Dreamers, this is all, I mean, I've hung around with Dreamers a little bit, but this, the research is other people's research, is not my own primary work. Anyway, both in that survey and in the in-depth interviews we did with the Occupy, supposedly didn't have leaders, but we identified people who were extremely active and that are leaders. We learned a number of things, and one of them was, one of the conclusions we reached was that, you know, part of what propelled this movement forward was just the ways in which this generation was affected by the downturn of 2008, and also by a longer-term transformation of the labor market that was underway before 2008, but was accelerated by it. So I know some of the labor people in this room study precarity and the growth of, you know, labor market insecurity and all that. So this has been happening for a while. It's not just about 2008, but the Great Recession, as we call it, and we call that here too, you know, very much accelerated those changes that were underway before. And of course, if you're first entering the job market, this affects you even more than those other people. So that's one piece. Student debt is another. I already mentioned biographical availability. But that was particularly acute in this moment because of underemployment. Actually, college-educated millennials were not unemployed any more than, they're actually less likely to be unemployed than many other groups of people, but they were often underemployed. They were working in jobs that they were overqualified for, working part-time when they wanted to work full-time, and so on. So that made them particularly available for this kind of thing. And then there's students. There's a book about the other movements of 2001 and immediately after by a guy called Paul Mason, who's a BBC reporter. Maybe you've seen it. It's called Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere. Why It's Still Kicking Off Everywhere. The Judge of the Arab Spring, and includes Occupy and Greece, so many other things. And he argues that all those movements were fueled by what he calls the graduate with no future. I hate to say this to college students, but there is something there in terms of, you know, you do everything you're supposed to do, you study hard, you get into college, you study in college, and then you face the post-2008 labor market. So that's the claim I'm trying to support here. So there's an economic disappointment driving some of this, and then there's also political disappointment, because although millennials were extremely enthusiastic about Barack Obama when he was a candidate, and when he became president, they were kind of disappointed with the lack of results. And we heard that a lot in our interviews. So that also radicalized people. So, you know, hope, change, and we didn't really get a whole lot of that. I mean, who's to blame for that may not be Barack Obama, but that's the reality of what happened, and we could argue about that. But in any case, that political disappointment was also part of what drove Occupy and what followed. So for all these reasons, I'm trying to convince you, we have this new political generation in Mannheim's sense of the word, and perhaps even a new left. That's that phrase comes from another commentator called Peter Weinart, who wrote a piece with that title, The New Left, that influenced me a lot in thinking about this. He's a political science journalist. So now, I mentioned before the Pew studies of millennials. Here's some of the data that they collect. This is just a sampling. If you're interested, you just Google millennials and Pew, and you'll find goths and this stuff is like hundreds of pages of survey findings. So, and this table just compares millennials to my generation. I guess this is a little narcissistic, but that's the standard comparison. Who, of course, were the protagonists of the last cycle of protests in the United States, now the so-called New Left of the 1960s and 70s. So this is the comparison. So I guess I won't read this all the way through. You can see it, but the interesting thing is that it's not, you know, the first kind of time this got on the radar for many people was in relation to the debate over same-sex marriage. And it was, there was a kind of really clear age gradient. The younger you were, the more likely you were to be positively viewing that proposal. And of course, that's completely, I say already, it's the law of the land in the U.S. But, and things like marijuana. But it extends to many other things. Like, I don't have labor on this list, but there are questions about that. Millennials are way more positive about labor rights than previous generations. You can see the immigrant thing, that support for immigrant rights. And the last one, have a positive view of socialism. Well, that's sort of obvious now with Bernie. But let me just say, I have a theory about that. I think it's connected to the 2008 campaign of Barack Obama. Because as you may know, at that time, the right wing pilloried Obama and said he was a socialist. This is before it was okay to announce you were a socialist like Bernie does. Obama never did that, and he probably isn't a socialist, actually. But he was labeled one by the right. And for the young people who thought he was the cat's pajamas, that meant, well, maybe socialism is okay, because after all, what does socialism mean to somebody who was born after 1980 and, you know, was 10 when the Soviet Union collapsed? It's sort of not, doesn't have the same meaning as it does for us older folks, the kind of all history of anti-communism is kind of not on the radar. So I think, I don't know, as my mother would say, what do they know from socialism? Doesn't, I don't know if that resonates in this crowd, but anyway, so I think that's what this is about. And, of course, we've seen further evidence of that since, but even as early as 2010, there were surveys that half of millennials think socialism is a good thing. I think that was driven by the Obama infatuation. Anyway, and then this is just the latest, the Sanders thing. Just, I don't know, if you watched the news last night, you know that the Iowa results were compelled a lot by the news. So, I had to look this up. what is it again? Best option ever or something? What does it stand for? BAA? Somebody young knows.
Before
this.
Anyone else.
Before anyone else, thank you. I had not seen that before, but. just the fact that us older people don't even know what the abbreviation means tells you something. All right, so then these are not in the Pew Center. I was able to get some of their unpublished data to look at the education gradient because they don't break it out that way, but it turns out. The more educated millennials are, the more, quote unquote, left-wing, liberal, whatever term you prefer, they are, the more progressive their attitudes are on multiple things. So, and then this last point is really important. Though I'm not going to say that much about it today, but I just want to underscore it for a minute. This term intersectionality, which comes out of my world of socialist feminism originally, this idea that all different kinds of oppression, gender oppression, race oppression, oppression based on sexuality, et cetera, that all these things are linked to one another. That is really embedded in the worldview of political activists from the millennial generation. So even if they might only work on one issue, like Black Lives Matter, say, they often, the leaders anyway, embrace this idea of intersectionality. And the word has become like an ordinary vocabulary word, but not. It started out as an obscure academic concept, actually, and now it's just part of the lexicon of this generation of political activists. So even if you only work on, if you're a dreamer and you work on the immigrant rights stuff, nevertheless, you understand the links between that and other social movements. So I think that's quite important, because a lot of these movements are sort of driven by single issues, but they're linked in some basic way. And there's also a certain amount of mobility just between, of activists among people. They might start an Occupy and then there's something else or whatever. So that's very striking in the rhetoric, and you'll see some examples of that in a minute. All right, so I'm just going to talk about two, although I'm fiddling around trying to expand this analysis, and I'd be very interested in people's thoughts to include Black Lives Matter and sexual assault stuff, but I haven't really completed the research on that. I'm just starting. So like I mentioned before, the Dreamers movement precedes all the hype about millennials, but it's still part of it in my view. I think I've covered all this already, actually. So Occupy was a very short-lived thing, as you may know. That was just a few months before the police evicted the occupiers from all the places that they occupied. But it turns out, and we have seen, one of my colleagues, Penny Lewis, has done some research on this. If you follow the individuals who were central to it, a lot of them are still active in some of these other movements or in other political ways. So we called our report on Occupy changing the subject for two reasons. One is the thing that I'll mention later that many people have pointed out, which is that the movement changed the conversation about inequality, et cetera. But it also created a new generation of political subjects, which is more important for what I'm trying to argue now. So Occupy itself vanished fast. Some people even call it a flash movement, as in flash mob, just on the radar for a few months. But it lives on in various ways in this new generation of activists, and also in terms of the continuing conversation about inequality. So I'm just going to say a little bit more about, first, the comparison between these two, occupiers and dreamers, because they have a lot of common characteristics. One of which is that although young people were the driving demographic of both, they were both mentored by older activists very explicitly. In the case of the Dreamers, the established immigrant rights movement was quite deliberately trained this generation of young undocumented people to tell their stories in very particular ways. I'll say more about that in a little bit. It really was a kind of offspring of the larger immigrant rights movement, which was led by older activists. And similarly, the parallel in Occupy is that many people who are involved in Islamist women, things like the Seattle protests of 1999 mentored the Occupy folks. So there were actually, trainings in civil disobedience and things like that, and it was the older generation of activists who taught the kind of protagonists of Occupy, the rules of the game, so to speak. So in both cases, there was that link to previous social movements or older activists. This is generational, probably, but for both, social media were very important in building the movement. So Manuel Castells, who's written about some of this stuff, says Occupy, in particular, was born on the internet, diffused by the internet. Turns out this is also true of the Dreamers. They make heavy use of social media. There's also this phenomenon. This is more Occupy than the Dreamers, but as the Dreamers became more involved in direct action, this was true for them too. This is just sociology jargon, so pardon me for the students in the room who aren't interested in that, but this is a phenomenon where social networks in some, aided by social media, defeated traditional social hierarchies in some cases. The police, and this has changed since, but in 2011, the surveillance agencies, like the national security agencies and the cops, didn't really get the social media thing too well. For example, the first time the police tried to clear Hyde Park in New York of the occupiers, Twitter summoned all sorts of people from across the Brooklyn Bridge into Brooklyn, and they actually backed off. That probably wouldn't happen anymore, but anyway, this stuff is not just like decoration, it's really central to the way these movements expanded. And of course, you probably, if you follow the Occupy thing, you may remember that, there are things, certain incidents that went viral on social media really amplified both the public awareness of the movement and helped it grow. So that all this was very central to the dynamic, and maybe a little bit less so for the Dreamers, but you see some of that there too. They certainly make use of these tools. The occupiers, the leaders we interviewed, many of them said, we never expected this to go on as long as it did. We thought it would be just one more. The police would evict us in a day. And for the first week or so, it wasn't really on the public radar, there was no media or anything. It wasn't on TV. And then through some errors of the police on the one side, because of this network over hierarchy thing, and through social media, it just spread like crazy. So I think that might not have happened without those tools. Who knows? That can be exaggerated too. The face-to-face interactions among these activists were also critical, and case of Occupy, it was the physical space that they occupied that was so central to the movement. And for the Dreamers, well, I haven't really said anything about this yet, but they use the metaphor. Many of the Dreamers' leaders are actually queer identified, and they use the metaphor of coming out, which of course comes out of the gay rights movement, to talk about coming out as undocumented individuals to make their status public, which is a scary thing to do, and that would not happen just over social media. You know, that requires building trust and physical so the other, another commonality between these two groups is that both, although at first this wasn't so true of the Dreamers, engaged in direct action, civil disobedience, both express negative views of the establishment of the nonprofit industrial complex. Those of you who know people who are involved in these movements might have heard them sneering at NGOs and things like that as being sort of, you know, unacceptably liberal, which is not a positive word in this context, entities. They are to the left of all that. So that's true of both movements as well. They see themselves as grassroots, genuine. So now, the next slide is just a little bit of data from our survey. So this is from early 2012. And just to, I mean, maybe there's not a doubt in your mind about that millennials being a relevant demographic, but that's what we found. So those under 30 were much more likely than the rest of the New York City population to have been actively engaged in Occupy, so I won't belabor this. And so in our survey, we surveyed, like I told you, a moving march. It was actually on May Day of 2012 by the time we were able to do it. So it was one of the last major marches in New York of Occupy. And it was a little bit contaminated by the fact that it was co-sponsored by lots of other groups. So we had a lot of people, older people involved, labor people, and so on as well. But we tried to kind of compensate for that by asking a lot of questions about people, the extent to which people were involved in Occupy. So some of these numbers came from that. If you're interested in more details, the full report is on the web. It's called, you can just Google me and changing the subject, you'll find it immediately. So the big thing we found that wasn't, we didn't really expect, was how much more highly educated the participants in Occupy were than we were comparing them to the overall New York population, since that's potentially well available to be part of this. As you can see, they were much more likely to be college educated. They were much wider. They were much richer. They were highly, you know, this goes with the education to some extent. I forgot my closed parentheses. They were also a little bit more male than the overall population. And there were all these jokes, you know, there was a big anarchist component to Occupy, and some people call it the Occupy anarchists. I'm getting too quiet, really? I'm sorry. All right. Here's just a couple of quotes from our interviews. Well, you can read them, but about the what propelled this, who these people were, what, how they got involved. And so just reinforcing what I was trying to suggest before, one interviewee said, a lot of people involved weren't working or not working full-time. They had all sorts of talents and energies, a set of skills that allowed them to explode this out, and that there's a fearlessness of young people. So it wasn't an accident that they were so young and so highly educated. And then there's a guy called David Graeber who's written quite a bit about this and was also directly involved in, but he was one of the older people who helped mentor the occupiers. And so he too commented on the youth and the access to, as he says, the entire history of radical thought, the high level of education and interest in these matters. Okay, shifting gears for a moment, I wanted to say a little bit about the Dreamers. You'll see where I'm going in a minute. Here's the full name of the, why they're called Dreamers. The Development, Relief, and Education for Alien Minors, that's a mouthful, Act, is the original origin of that term. The Dreamers also mostly have some college education, partly because the DREAM Act, if it were ever passed, it's partly conditioned on education, but also military service, which is kind of ironic. And a lot of the initial organizing among the Dreamers took place on college campuses. I used to teach at UCLA, and that because Los Angeles has the largest single folks in the United States. That's one of the places where this emerged first. Because this movement, you know, it started in the early 2000s, and it's dragged on and on in the absence of passing any of this legislation. The activists had gotten older and graduated from, they've joined the ranks of what Mason called the graduates with no future over time. They started out as students, but very eventually are no longer students. So it's kind of an extreme case of what I was talking about before in relation to biographical availability. These are because, I don't know how much people know about being undocumented in the United States, but you can go to school forever, actually, if you can find the money to do it and not have to work. But you can't legally work in the country without documents. And so, as this is a quote from not my own research, the Dreamers are stuck. It's bad for them, but it's good for organizers. They are extremely available biographically in that respect.
Wasn't there that reporter in the U.S., I think his name was Jose Vargas,
who came out? Uh-huh.
Yeah, he was a Dreamer. He managed to establish a career. He decided to...
Somehow. Yes, and that's one example. Did everybody hear what he said? There's this guy, I forget his middle name, but it's Jose Vargas, who is a journalist, who's a Dreamer, and came and was able to get employment. And the other thing is, since then, one of the triumphs of the Dreamers is DACA, which is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which I'll say a little bit more about later, and I believe he benefited from that as well. So that gives you temporary legal status, and then you can work. But prior to that, there was no option. So people would go, you know, they would go to school, they would go to graduate school. You could get fellowships, you could get stipends even from foundations and that kind of thing. But you could work in the underground economy, which many, many people do. You know, work cleaning houses or working in various low-wage jobs that, you know, are not on the radar of the authorities, right? So, you know, people do that. But in terms of a legal employment system, so that's the underemployment. That's what I'm trying to suggest. That makes you available for this kind of political activity, besides adding to your motivation to participate in it. So, thanks. So I'm kind of more interested here in the contrast between these two movements, so they obviously have a lot in common, as I've tried to say already. So here are a few ways in which we see some differences. Let me just preview this by saying, like, the title of the talk, Insiders and Outsiders, is sort of driven by this. So the occupiers, as I explained, were affluent, largely white, somewhat more male than female. They are quintessential insiders in the society, right? Although, affected disproportionately by the Great Recession and everything, but basically, you know, born to the man or born, kind of, right? The Dreamers aren't like that. They're undocumented kids, so they're very different. They're outsiders to the society in some way. So I think you'll see the point of that, and I'll try to make the argument that helps explain their political approaches. So the occupiers are disproportionately white and male. The Dreamers, the opposite, disproportionately female. So I have a whole theory about that, which maybe we can talk about later, but I can't explain the queer part, but I think there's a reason why women are more in the leadership of this, which is to do with this gender dynamics of migration. And actually, I learned a lot from Lewin's research in a different context that helped me understand that, but about the HTAs and all. It's sort of the opposite, but anyway, we can talk about that later if people are interested. Anyway, that's a really striking difference in who the leaders are, right, in terms of gender and so on. And the participants as well. The ideology of Occupy, of course, was about inequality in general, especially class inequality. If you scratch an occupier, and you will hear talk about intersectionality, but that was not very central to the movement. It was really focused on class privilege, and ironically. The Dreamers, by contrast, talk about intersectionality constantly. Like, that's part of their worldview. The occupiers were, as you may know, devoted to what they call horizontalism. They didn't believe in hierarchy. They didn't have any leaders, they said. They wanted, you know, participatory democracy. Everything was decided by consensus. Very extreme anarchist influence kind of approach to how you organize something. Dreamers aren't like that. They have regular meetings, you know, like elects of leaders and stuff like that. To make decisions. Very different. The occupiers deliberately avoided having a list of demands. they did have a sort of set of principles that they, you know, adopted that guided their work, but they weren't interested in saying, we want, you know, the Glass-Steagall Act to be restored or something. Like, they weren't interested in particular demands. The Dreamers are, you know, they want the Dream Act, they want driver's licenses, they want institution, you know, very specific, legislation and so forth. So very different that way. Of course, the Dreamers have outlasted Occupy. They started before and lasted much longer. And they also have somewhat different reference points. They both see themselves as connected to other social movements, but different ones. So the Occupiers, actually one of my favorite artifacts of Occupy is this, they published something called the Occupy Wall Street Journal early on in the occupation. It was like a printed newspaper. And the first issue was a brilliant piece of journalism. And the first issue on the inside kind of centerfold, there was a like timeline of, you know, starting with the Arab Spring, of all the other movements that they saw themselves as connected to, the Indignados in Spain and so on. In the case of the Dreamers, the reference points are the civil rights movement on the one hand from the 1960s and the LGBTQ movement, as I already talked about, the coming out metaphor that they adopt. Another difference is that the Dreamers really were big at the beginning, especially on some social movements writers talk about storytelling as a political strategy, and they were very, this was very central for them. So like I mentioned, the older immigrant rights folks trained them from the outset in messaging and storytelling. That was very explicit. So there was a kind of standard narrative that they adopted and actually had lived. So the typical story went something like this. I was brought to the United States by my parents when I was 4, or my age like that. I didn't know what was going on. I was raised in the United States. I don't know anything about Mexico or Guatemala or wherever they're from, right? I only found out I was undocumented when it came time to apply for college, and I found out I didn't have a social security number, so I couldn't fill out the forms. And then my parents revealed the truth to me, you know, that kind of thing. I'm as American as you can get, and besides, I'm a straight-A student, and I work hard, and, you know, all the rest of it. And in fact, the people that were the poster children for this movement did embody that narrative. They really were like that. They were straight-A, you know, that all this was true of them. But they're not the only undocumented kids, of course. That was sort of those were the ones who were lifted up and who were celebrated by the movement and were the best, you know, advocates for it. I mean, it's completely logical if you're trying to persuade the wider public that this is something, you know, an important issue. So that this was a strategy to get media attention and to win sympathy. They didn't quite succeed, and they got some media attention, but this didn't quite work. But so what I'm suggesting is, again, they're outsiders. The subtext here is, we did everything right. Why won't you let us into society, right? It's kind of the opposite of Occupy, which is, we did everything right. Why are you kicking us out? So, okay. So here's a typical Dreamer narrative. I'll read it out. I think I still have time. When am I supposed to stop, by the way? Where's Louis?
Well, we started a little late, and we want to leave for questions, maybe 5 more minutes.
5 more minutes. Okay, then I won't read this. You can read it yourself.
Oh,
but
no!
It's just, all right, whatever.
Have a horizontal decision.
It's really what I already told you, only more poetic because it's in the person's words. So I'll go through it really quick. Growing up, I didn't have any friends who were undocumented, and I was unaware of my own immigration status until I was 15. When I was 15, I decided it was time to get a job because my parents didn't have a lot of money. I wanted to buy things for myself. It was then that my parents notified me that I could not get a job because I had not been born in this country. So if you've come young enough, you don't even know where you were born, right? Do you know where you were born? I mean, you know, but you don't remember it. From that point of view, my view of what my life would be like completely changed. My work experiences have very much been under the table. I had to wake up every morning before sunrise to work, attended class late at night, blah, blah, blah. The work ethic. I worked very hard in school, earned good grades, I did everything right. But I felt humiliated. It was very hard to realize that even though I felt like a young American, had been educated entirely in this nation, my immigration status limited my options and ultimately how I could live my life. There's a book that was published by the UCLA Labor Center called Underground Undergraduate, which is full of these stories that if you want to read more. So now this changed. As the Dreamers aged, they
edgy. They came out of the closet in other ways. Many of them were, you know, of sexual minorities. And they also, so that poster is an example of queer, undocumented, and unfriendly. They also embraced their parents' actions. They, you know, because the implication of the original narrative is that, well, my parents might have done something wrong crossing the border without authorization, but, you know, not me. And they changed that to sort of say, you know, my parents did this for me. They wanted us to have a better life. So they began defending that much more. They basically moved, they became more radical over time. So I think I already covered this, that their organizations, the Dreamers Organization, and there's a bunch of them, and we could debate this. There's some divisions within this movement, too, and so some are a little different from others. But basically, they're fairly conventional, unlike the horizontalism of Occupy. They do conventional lobbying and so on, but as they become more radical and more frustrated, perhaps, by the limited progress that they've made, though they've actually won quite a few things, they've gotten more militant, and they've become involved in direct actions, which was the kind of mantra of Occupy, too. So they've sat in on various senatorial offices and so on, actually also in the detention center. They've blocked intersections on hunger. You know, they've become, they've embraced some of these other tactics. But fundamentally, they use conventional politics. And they've mostly won, you know, concrete demands. As opposed, even though it's ironic because their storytelling was so important to their movement in the beginning, they really haven't changed the narrative. Look at the debate about immigration now in the United States with these Republicans talking about supporting people and everything. You know, they haven't made much headway on that, but they have won a lot of concrete things like DACA, driver's licenses, mid-state tuition, and all the rest of it. So there's a DACA 2, a more expanded DACA, and DAPA, which is Deferred Action for, but it would be for adults, basically some of their parents, not quite everybody, that Obama issued an executive order that would have expanded all this, and then it was blocked in the courts. The Supreme Court of the United States is going to make a decision this June about the validity of those executive orders. So, but that was a victory in a way, even though it hasn't been implemented. So they've been quite successful in terms of winning concrete things. Unlike Occupy, which did very little storytelling, but instead of winning concrete demands, which has not done at all, it did change the narrative. It did, which was kind of, so it's the opposite of what they aspire to, maybe. So Occupy was a prefigurative form of politics. That just means trying to create in the movement the society, a decent society, the kind of society you're fighting for. You know, so in the occupation, they had libraries and kitchens and all the rest of it. And how many people here were involved in Occupy? Anybody? So, you know, not so many. But anyway, that was a big part of it. So this is more sociology jargon, but the idea is that you're prefiguring the kind of world you want to create and you're fighting for in the movement itself. So there was a lot of that. But that took the form of rejecting like mainstream electoral politics lobbying and, you know, trying to win like pieces of legislation. They disdained all that. I think that reflected the fact that the occupiers were insiders, socially speaking. Right, they could look down on all that because they took it all for granted in some sense. I'm almost done. So, but they did change the conversation. So I don't know if you can really see this, but this tracks the news mentions of income inequality. Prior to Occupy, so the first part of the graph before that first bump up here, this is when Occupy starts, basically. This is how often inequality is mentioned. So it peaks during the occupation, then it goes down a bunch, it comes back up at various points. But they permanently, you know, even right-wingers feel that they have to talk about inequality now all the time. It's become part of the, you know, the conversation. I could go on about that. Let me just wrap this up. So, again, the Dreamers start out with this storytelling strategy, and yet what they actually win is concrete concession. While the culture, the kind of acceptance of undocumented immigrants hasn't made too much headway. Occupy's impact is the opposite, that the impact has been more on the level of discourse. The movement, of course, is no longer there. So this part I'm not so sure about, but I would love to talk about it with you if you have thoughts. Which is the extent to which these different strategies might reflect the insider-outsider positions I mentioned, that the insiders have this more prefigurative politics and the outsiders more conventional.
reason I'm less sure about that, then I started out with all that, and I thought that was going to be my argument. I'm going to tell you the inside story here. Then I started thinking about Black Lives Matter, and they're outsiders too, but it's an anti-systemic movement like Occupy. It's not focused on, you know, particular demands, right? So that breaks down my theory a little bit, but we can talk about that later. And then the bigger point is just that the basic conditions that spawn both these movements, along with Black Lives Matter and some others, you know, is to do with this notion of political generations that I began the talk with. That's not an accident that these are millennials, led by college-educated. And I have done enough research on Black Lives Matter, by the way, to document that the leaders are almost all. I've been collecting like the names of Black Lives Matter leaders mentioned in the news media and then looking them up on Facebook and stuff, and they're all overwhelmingly college educated, many of them women, many of them queer, just like dreamers. So let me stop there and talk. Any comments, questions?